The AutJet Business Show is your gateway to expert business advice and real-world success stories. Each week, a different leader in the business world will share their tips, insights, and lessons, offering you practical advice to navigate your entrepreneurial journey. Whether you have a business idea or are just starting out or looking to elevate your existing business, the AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Ensure you get these transformative conversations live on Thursdays at 6 p.m. or find the podcast at highfm.com. Let's build your business empire together.
Welcome, welcome. It's that time of the week again. It's Thursday evening. I'm David Zeidel and this is the AutJet Business Show. And in fact, tonight is show number 67. If you've missed some of the shows, you can go to the High FM website, go to the podcast, and pick up all the interviews that we've had up until now, all the previous 66. But tonight with us, we've got Ivar Harberger. He's the former CEO of Gallo Records. Good evening, Ivar.
Hello, David. Hello, the listeners.
It's really great to have Ivar with us tonight. And for those who don't know, Ivar is a titan of the South African music industry. He's known as the original music industry hustler. Ivar's journey is legendary. He began his career by blasting music through Mashadidop to promote records and personal networking. And he gave every DJ and producer at the SABC a record to get them to play it. And over a remarkable 40-year career at Gallo Records, he worked across marketing, sales, and A&R, before eventually rising to the position of CEO of Gallo and Warner Music Group. Ivar's impact on the musical landscape is massive. He was instrumental in bringing international icons like Barry White, Donna Summers, and Bonnie M to South Africa, while also signing some of the country's most beloved legends, including, and you'll know these names, Maria Makeba, Lady Smith Black Mabasa, Lucky Dube, and Sipho Hot Sticks Mabuza. And beyond his corporate success, Ivar's deep understanding of the industry led him to be a mediator in complex intellectual property disputes involving dozens of iconic artists, and he'll share some of that with us. Whether he is sharing business lessons that can't be found in textbooks or reflecting on the golden era of South African music, there is no one better to guide us through the business of entertainment. And we're going to get all these stories from Ivar, but if you listen to the show, you know that I begin with a short business lesson. And tonight's business lesson comes from chapter 11 of my book, Basic Business Calculation. And the heading of that chapter is, it's the hardest just before the breakthrough. And in fact, this was the beginning of what got me onto the road of writing this book, the lessons that you learn through running that apply to life and business in general. And I was running a race and I was going up this very, very steep hill. It was a race called Umdi Dam, around the dam. And I think it's about 50 or 56 kilometers. And when you get to almost a marathon place, like you've almost finished a marathon, you're faced with this massive, massive hill. And I was running up this hill. And the more you run up the hill, then the more tired you get, the more you just look down in front of your feet and you don't look up. And I was going up this hill and getting more and more tired. And at some stage, I thought, no, I just can't do this. And at that point, I looked up and I realized how close I was to the top. That gave me the impetus just to push a little bit further, and then I went over the top, and coming down, it became easy again. And I thought to myself, how many times has that happened to me in life, where it got really, really hard, and at that point, I kind of said, no, I can't do this, and I changed, because in life, sometimes you can't see where the top of the hill is. So the lesson for tonight is, sometimes when it really, really feels like it's getting hard, just look at it and reframe it and think to yourself, maybe that's a sign that you've almost at the peak and it's going to get easy after that. So that's a business lesson from me, but we've got an hour with Ivar to talk about your business lessons and, Ivor, your history in the business, the music business. So I think just to get going, let me ask you, I know you grew up as a kid in Bloemfontein, and how did you get started in the music world?
First of all, my father had a music store at 122 Maitland Street in Bloemfontein. And there they used to sell sheet music, they used to build pianos, they had a small record bar, and I used to hang around there. And before I knew it, I was called up into the army. And when was I called up into the army? In the 1st of April. School finished at the end of November, and I had to find something to do between January and April. And what I did was I came up to Johannesburg. My folks said, go to Joburg and see what's going on. There's nothing in Bloemfontein. And at that time, the biggest record store in South Africa was the OK Bazaars in Van Villach Street in Johannesburg, in Van Bronder Street in Johannesburg. And I used to go and hang around there and see what was playing and what music was going on. While I was there, a gentleman came up to me and he said to me, if you're so interested in music, why don't you come and join us? I said, but I've got to go to the army. He said, well, when you finish the army, come and see us as well. I said, well, then I've got to study. He said, come and see us as well. When I got back, I actually put a call through and I went to see them. And they said, you know, we control a lot of the record wars in the whole of South Africa. And there are opportunities for you to join. And that's where I started it. I went back after the army and I joined them. And they first said to me, oh, before you know, you've got to go and work in the warehouse for 6 months and pull in records. And so I went in there. Then that's when I came out, finished
so,
that.
So just before you went there, your very first bit when you were in Joburg, hanging around the OK Bazaars, were you just spending hours and hours in the music store?
I was looking and seeing what was selling and what music was going, and it was a very exciting place because where were the kids going? You know, there was nothing really happening. People used to hang around the record bars, and they used to play music, and they used to chat, and, it was very sociable in those days. And the amount of sales were enormous there. And that was the biggest store in South Africa at the time.
So were you musical yourself, or you came from this musical family?
I tell you, my mother sent me to Mrs. Shepston for music lessons and piano lessons. And after about 18 months, Mrs. Shepston phoned my mother and said, get him out of here, he's tone deaf. And that's true. I've got no music background. I understand it, but I know how to pick the hits.
That's amazing, amazing. So then did you go to the army and then come back?
I went to the army, then I came back, and then I joined them. And as I said, I had to go to do the warehouse situation. Then they put me on the road with the reps to sell products. Then I came back. And
so
then
when you say to sell products, so what were you selling and to who?
I was selling to all the record stores and spas, not spas, but in those days it used to be the bicycle shops. Especially in Pretoria, it was big, and the mining areas was big as well. They had all these shops, and we used to go and sell. But they said, you've got to get experience. Get out there and sell. So that's what I did. Then I came back, and they put me in the promotions department. And the promotions department was servicing the radio stations. Well, it was mainly the SABC, and getting your records played. And I used to go out and find and listen to the DJs and actually say, please play this, this is a hit record, this is doing well in America, this is doing well here.
Was it still vinyl records in those
still
days?
Still a lot of vinyl.
Okay, and was it those, what do they call them, the singles? Or the
seven singles, but prior to that it was the shellac. I don't know if you remember, they used to break the shellacs, you used to drop them, and they used to shatter. But that was prior to me. That was prior to me getting. But at that time, you know, the SABC was the big carrier of music. Okay, there was LM Radio and stuff like that. But you had to get your products at the SABC. And there was no security in those days. You used to just arrive there and put seven singles on the DJ's desk and hope they, you know, with a little bit of note, please play this and whatever. And that's how it started off.
Just an interesting thing. Why was it called seven singles? Were there seven tunes on it?
No, only one tune on each side.
So why? Yeah. Where I don't did
know
the
where
seven?
I don't know where the seven came. Okay. Maybe they were 7 inches.
Maybe
seven inches across. Yeah.
So you used to go and you used to try and get the DJs to play
the records, and then we'd see that the reps went out and whatever. But we also controlled a lot of the radio stations on not radio. We didn't control, but we had time on radio. We had the 6 o'clock was the show with Peter Lotus, and he had 15 minutes, and he actually worked for Gallo at one time. So it was called the Radio Record Club at 6 o'clock, and we used to play stuff there. Then on a Wednesday night, we had the Magic of Music. Then there was Beacon Light Up the Scenes on a Wednesday afternoon at 5:15. And those shows we could program. We could put it the products that we were programmed on. And Peter Lotus was a big name in those days because he had the surf show Pickerbox. I don't know if you remember some of these shows on Spreaker Radio. So he was a big name. And he also used to sing also with Dan Hill and various other people. He was a great personality. And I used to work under him. He used to show me the ropes, program this, we're doing this, this is what we're promoting. And I learned a lot from Peter. And eventually Peter, you know, left the organization. And then they said to me, Peter Lowe's actually came to me the one day and he said, you know, Ivor, we've got problems with 20th Century Fox. I said, what's the problem with 20th? He says, we've released one record out of their whole catalog and they're very upset about it. I said, which record have we released? And they said it was Zorba the Greek from the film. And it was very popular at the time because people were going to weddings, they were trying to do Greek dancing and stuff like that. And he handed me about 50 albums and said, take these home and find something that we can release. And going through that product, I found a guy called Barry White. And I started playing Barry White, and I think this guy's a hit.
So was Barry already famous in America?
Only in America.
In America, but yeah. Not in South Africa?
Not around the world.
So you listened to this and you thought, hang on a second, this guy's a hit.
Right. So I got hold of 20th Century Fox and I said to them, please send me 25 albums of Barry White. The albums arrived and I started taking it to the DJ, to the clubs in those days. There was, I don't know if you remember, there was the top of the post office, there was a club there. There was the Yellow Submarine, there was the Chelsea Hotel, there were all these different clubs, and I started taking it around at night and saying to the DJs, please play, please play, please play. And all of a sudden, the reps came back to us, and they said, they've been asking for Barry White. Who's got Barry White? I said, we'll have Barry White. I brought in 250. Those went, in a week, they were all gone, and Barry White started exploding. And eventually, we sold about 180,000 Barry Whites over a period of about 3 to 5 years, and you still hear him being played at the moment. You hear Barry White. And then they flew me to Las Vegas and they presented me with an award for the best territory outside America that sold Barry White. And from Barry White, there was the Love Unlimited Orchestra, which was the orchestra that played with Barry. And then there were three girls, Love Unlimited, and we started releasing all these products. And still today, you're hearing those probably 50 years ago, you're still hearing all that product.
And then you also, you were involved with people like Donna Summers and right. Bonnie M. What's the story behind them?
Okay, well, the story behind Bonnie M. was there is a film festival and music festival in Cannes every year. Every year, and people go and they have 12 to 14,000 people used to attend the conference. I went to Gallo and I said, look, I'd like to go to Cannes. And they said to me, we haven't got budget. They said, the three of us going, Peter Gallo's going, Peter Lotus is going, and John Edmonds going. And we just haven't got enough money. So I said, look, if I are able to finance it, can I come with Gallo? Can I be part of the registration with Gallo? And they said, well, if you want to pay for your own air tickets and your own accommodation, you can go. So I said, okay.
We want to pick up on the rest of that story, but we'll do it after the break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You're listening to the AutJet Business Show on Chai FM 101.9. I'm David Zeidel. And we're starting to hear the story of Ivor Harberger, the former CEO of Gallo Records. And Ivor was saying he grew up in Bloemfontein and just before the army came down to Joburg, not knowing what to do for the few months, used to hang out in the OK Bazaar's record store, listened to the records, got involved in music, and they saw that he was so interested in it, they invited him back when he finished the army to join the company. And one thing led to the next, and then they asked him to find all these different records that they could promote, and he listened through it. And although he said he can't hold the tune himself, he understands tunes, And he heard Barry White and he thought, this is a seller. And he promoted that and it went through and Barry White's record sold, what did you say, 180,000?
180,000 units over the period, yes.
Over the period. That's incredible. And then from there, got involved with different things. And just before the break, you were saying you wanted to go to Cannes. And although you said you can, they said you can't. So you said, no, I can. And you were going to fund your own way. So take us through that story.
So I thought I really wanted to go. I said, that's where the music industry happens. So I went to a Republican Press and they had certain magazines, Scope, which some people remember, Personality, the Farmers Weekly,
I think it was called,
and a couple of others. And I went to a guy called Al Fent and I said, Al, listen, I want to go to Cannes. Do you need a journalist to do pictures and do stories? He said, no, that's a good idea. He says, well, when you're there, you can take the pictures, do the stories, and come back and present them to me. So I got on the plane. I took the plane to Nice. From Nice, I went to Cannes. I booked into this hotel. It was on the railway line, and the trains were going past and whatever, and I go into my room, and you could see through the towels. It was really a one-star hotel, but I thought, I'm close to the venue, and I'm going to make the most of it. And I started going around the stands and I saw this one stand with Boney M on the stand. And I thought, God, that's great for South Africa. That's going to be a huge seller in South Africa. And I got all the details and I said, I'd like to represent you in South Africa. And when we got back to Johannesburg.
So just before you go there, what was it that made you think they're going to be good for South Africa?
First of all, they had huge speakers and they had these pictures of the group on the stand with videos and stuff like that. And I thought this is going to be great. And I listened to the music they were playing, and I said, this is for us. I got back to Johannesburg, and I said, got all the various details and things, and I had the meeting with Gallo, and I said, I wanted to sign Boney M. And they wanted a certain amount of money up front because they never heard us before. And Gallo said, it's too much. We're not prepared to pay this amount of money. So I said, you know, maybe I should go on my own now, you know, with the financing. But I thought, I was a member and I spoke about it. And eventually I got the money and I did the deal with Boney M. And we released the first record, which was something called Daddy Cool. Mm. And Daddy Cool sold about 55,000 seven singles, as you were talking. And we released the various products of Boney M. And they were a huge success. Everything that we did just sold 50, 60, 70,000. And to bring everybody back, they then said, they released the Christmas album. And they said, guys, you want the Christmas album? We want money. We want money up front. We're not just going to give it to you. And I discussed it with Gallo, whatever. And I said, it's going to be a great Christmas album. And once again, there was the issue of with what they called the advance. Mm. The advance they wanted was like 35,000 dates marks in those days. And eventually they said, okay, do the deal. I got hold of a guy called Hans Jochmeyer, and I said, Hans, can we meet? I want to bring the check, have the contract ready, and I'll sign the contract, give me the master tapes, and I'll fly back to Joburg. I got on the plane, I arrived, went to the airport, booked into the Intercontinental Hotel, and met the guys, and there was a handover. Here's your check, here are your master tapes, here's your negs. And I came back on the plane that day, and I went straight to the factory, and I put the record into production.
So what happens? You get a master tape, and then from that you
manufacture and whatever, but you need the everything to go with it. And I got back to Joburg and I went straight to the factory in Steelhard and I said, right, start pressing. And that Christmas album sold thousands. Wherever you went to a shopping center or whatever, that Boney M. Christmas album. You go now, it's last Christmas now, you go into some of the stores, they're still playing Boney M. And that album has done about 800,000 units today.
Wow.
So that was one of the big ones, you know.
So what was it that made you be able to spot something and say, that's going to be a record? Or did you first take it and did you turn it into a success?
Some of the things I liked that I thought would be good for South Africa. And the three girls that were heading Boney M were dressed properly. They looked good. they could dance. And the guy that's, well, his voice was overdubbed, but he was a great dancer in front and he mixed up well. And I thought, this is just going to be great for South Africa.
Mm. So, I mean, was it something that you just, it was inherent in you, or was it a skill, or was it just sat inside?
It sat inside, and as I said, I was tone deaf, but I knew what was good and what was bad. And sometimes, you know, you're good as your last record. You know, some of the artists, you have a great seller, but your next one comes out and it's not as good, and people don't want it.
So what were some of those flops or some of the things that didn't work?
Well, I had one, it was called Who's Fooling Who by Bohannon, and we sold about over 100,000. And they named one of the soccer players Who's Fooling Who, in, I think from Pirates or whatever, that's how popular the song was. And we pressed up the next one, and nobody wanted it. It was just crazy. Here you had a big hit, did 100,000 units, and the next one comes and it's stuck in the warehouse for 1,500 units that we pressed was there. It never moved out. So you've got to be very lucky. As I said, you're as good as your last record.
And then you also dealt a lot, as I said in the introduction, with South African artists.
Yes.
Some huge names like Miriam Makeba, Lady Smith, Black Mabasa, Lucky Dube, Sipot Six Mabusa. So again, just take us through the story, of each one or some of them that you want to go through.
So we'll start with Lady Smith Black Mabasa because a lot of people know Lady Smith Black Mabasa. So what happened was I was working very closely in the black market, you know, the traditional black market, but we call them skandi and music like that. And we had studios on the first floor of our building at Gallo in Kirk Street. And I used to go down there and whatever and listen to the music that was playing and what they were rehearsing. And then a guy by the name of Weston, of course, he was the head of our A&R in our local division, black division, said,
"What is the A&R?
Artist and Repertoire."
Okay.
And he said to me, "Ivor, we've got to go to Durban." I said, "Why must we go to Durban?" He says, "I heard this band called Ladysmith Black Mabasa. They're a choir doing Mbube music." I said, "West, how did you hear them? You know, tell me, how did it go?" He said, "I heard them on Inkosi FM, which was Radio Zulu, you know." And we went down and we met the radio station there and we said, "Where do we get hold of Ladysmith Black Mabasa?" And we made the introduction to Ladysmith. And West in Zulu had explained to them that we are a record company and we want to put their stuff on CD, not CD, on cassette and album. And we had negotiations, and they couldn't understand exactly what we wanted to do. We then got a lawyer called Edmund Radebe, who they appointed, and we explained to Edmund, we want to sign a contract, a long-term contract with Ladysmith. We want to record albums, we want to do albums, we want to market the group and put them out. And eventually, after lots of discussion and backwards and forwards, we brought them up to Johannesburg and we started recording Ladysmith Black Mabasa.
So just before you go further on with that story, because I know they were involved with Paul Simon as well, just take us through the business of the music business. When you say you sign a contract, what is the general for, let's say somebody's a musician out there, what is the general things that they should look at and what are the normal terms and conditions?
First of all, a contract is normally an exclusive contract. Once he signs to the record company and she signs to the record company, she can't move around. She's devoted to that record company. So you normally sign a deal for 3 years and you decide on a royalty that you're going to pay them on the sales of the record. And also, who's going to pick up the costs? Because you've got to go into a studio, you've got to hire an engineer, you've got to hire the producer, you've got to pay for the studio. And that all comes part of the negotiation. And at Gallows, we had our own studios, which has made things a lot easier, that we could book the studios. We had our own legal department, which looked at contracts and stuff like that. And we had to do a lot of explanation. And on the front page of all our contracts, I put there, please see a lawyer to advise you on the signing of these contracts. Because we didn't want building an artist and without knowing it, they're making another album with somebody else. You know, you sign in exclusive rights. And you've had to be close to the artist and explain what they were doing. This is what the release date is. We need a photo session. We're going to do press. We're going to do TV. You know, you've got to do the whole routine. And Ladysmith were great. And every record has a number, a catalogue number. So they started off, and I still remember all their numbers because they were so popular. It was LB 13, 17, 26, 86 were all the different titles of their albums that I knew. And I became very, very close to Ladysmith, guiding in their career. And they were with me for 37 years, personally. When I started 3 years, I signed every contract with them. I did a lot of the international negotiations, you know, because here I had this Zulu group. What do I do with them? So that's when I started negotiating with international artists to go on shows and doing things and doing recordings with them.
So you started off bringing international people to South Africa, and now you're moving them back overseas.
We did a lot of the recordings overseas. We didn't do those recordings here with the international artists.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But you brought the songs to South Africa, and now you're taking the South African songs overseas. And what happened with the Paul Simon, the collaboration? Were you involved in that?
Very much so. So what happened is, at that time, my boss was a guy called Peter Gallo, and he was part of the Gallo family. And he read in the Sunday Times that Paul Simon was coming to South Africa. And he said, I've got to meet him. Go and see what we can do with Paul Simon. So I felt a little bit, geez, how can I go to Paul Simon and just start talking to him? So eventually, Paul arrived. I heard he was in the country, and he was working at Satbel Studios in town. And I decided to go to Satbel Studios and see if I could get a handshake or introduction. And then the engineer there was Peter Twaits, who was one of the engineers at Satbel. And Peter Twaits used to work for Gallo at one time in our studios, and he moved over, got a better offer from Satbel, and he moved over. And that's how I got into Paul Simon. And then I said, look, if you need Ladysmith, if you need a guitarist, if you need a bass player, that's my card. Just phone me and I'll organize. The next thing they said, look, is it possible to get hold of Ladysmith? I said, sure, they live in Durban. I'll bring Joseph up. So I called Joseph and I said, listen, I'm sending an air ticket to you. I'll meet you at the airport. I want you to meet with Paul Simon. He said to me, who's Paul Simon? Hmm. He's never heard of Paul Simon. So I said, look, when I'm in my...
Wait, was Paul big in those days?
Yeah, he was big.
Okay.
But he'd never heard of Paul Simon. So I got hold of him at the airport and I put... Simon and Garfunkel in my cassette player, and I said, this is what we're going to meet, Paul Simon. So he said, oh, very good, very good. And I took him to the Satbel Studios, and I left him there with Paul or whatever. And I said to them, look, if you need a guitarist, I've got Ray Peary, who can play rhythm, he can play lead. Next thing they found and said to me, look, can you get hold of Ray Peary? And I got hold of Ray Peary, and he belonged to one of my bands, Ray Peary. Then they wanted a drummer, and I said, I've got a great drummer. I've got Isaac Levin. So Isaac came up, and he did that. And then there was a bass player, and he wasn't with Gallo at the time. He was with EMI, which was the opposition. So I got hold of Bagiti Kamala, and I said, Bagiti, don't you want to come and do some sessions with Paul Simon? He said, I'd love to. And he joined the band as well. But that whole band that Paul Simon had from Ladysmith were part of my group, part of the Gallo. And I had contracts with each and every one of those artists. And we said, look, with those artists, let them go one step further. If Paul wants them, it's great for South African artists to work with Paul, to understand the music, to understand working in the studios. And that's how it all began.
Because the song I remember the most, I think it was Diamonds on the Soles of My Shoes.
Yeah, yeah. And the live performance of that was terrific. Absolutely terrific.
Where was the live performance?
All over the world.
So
Ladysmith went on tour with, Ray Peary went on tour. They all went on tour with Wild Swimmer.
And then they were still contracted under Gallo.
Under Gallo, yeah.
And Paul Simon obviously had his own studio, so was that not a conflict?
No. He used to rent. Okay. He used to rent studios and work with the artists. A lot of work goes into it. You know, they couldn't, you know, there was the understanding, the problems. And I also had the problems when sending the bands overseas because I had to get visas. You know, for everybody to travel overseas. And, you know, it wasn't tourist visas. They were going to work at one time. And I had issues at Heathrow with one of my band members because he said, we're coming to work. And he says, but where's your work permit? Who are you going to work with? So they kept us all back. But we said, no, it's not working, it's rehearsing, because we went to London to do the rehearsals for the Graceland album.
Okay. And so where were you... in the hierarchy of Gallo at this stage? Were you CEO at that stage?
No.
So, you know, just talk us through the progress. So for those who have just maybe got into their cars and thinking, who are we listening to? You're listening to Ivor Harberger, who's the former CEO of Gallo Records, and he's taking us through some of his experiences and relationships with the singers.
Yeah.
So just talk us through, where were you and how did you progress further through the organization?
You know, I was like head of, I used to work under Peter Gallo at the time. And Peter Gallo was the letter, it was the chairman, if you would. And I used to meet with him for a cup of coffee every day at 9 o'clock. And he used to question me, what are we doing with this artist? Have you done this? Have we got TV advertising? Are we doing the press? When? Next morning, cup of coffee. Have you done this? Have you sorted this out? So I was like the runner in those days, working with the artists, doing the promotion and finding the products. So I had a great job there. But it was going out at night, listening to the bands, bringing people in, spending time in the studios with them.
So was this, did this match your personality? Was this, were you,
I never took the front. My artists were more important than me. I used to do the guidance, sorting them out, doing the tours, doing things, making sure things worked.
And then how did you progress through the organization?
They found me because I was producing the hits.
Hmm.
So we talked about Boney M, and then there was Donna Summer. And I was on holiday in Mauritius, and I went to a club one day, and I heard this record played. And I went to the DJ and said, have you got a pen and pencil? I need to know who this artist is. I wrote it down. It was Donna Summer, producer, Giorgio Moroder, and whatever. In those days, we didn't have the internet to find these artists.
Mm.
And eventually, I found a company called Hansa in Germany, in Berlin, and I said, I'm trying to find a German producer called Giorgio Moroder. And they said, this is his phone number. He works out of Munich, and give him a call. And I phoned him up, and I said, I've listened to Donna Summer. I've heard it in Mauritius. I'd like it for South Africa. And we did a deal, and I said, I don't want just one of her albums. I want the next three in the contract. And we had the first record that came out was Love to Love You Baby by Donna Summer, and it had heavy breathing on it.
Mm.
And I took it to all the clubs again, and people started asking, and then it went into the stores. It was flying in the stores. SABC put a ban on it because of the...
Because of the heavy breathing.
Because of the heavy breathing. The next thing is we went back to Georgia, and he said, could we take the heavy breathing out? And we announced it in the paper. It's now back on sale without the breathing. People went and bought it. We went back again and said, listen, please, let's open this up. It hasn't been banned anywhere else in the world. Can it go out? We announced it again over radio. It's now available. It sold another 100,000 of Donna Summer. So it was amazing, this whole thing, but it sold a lot of records.
And then did the subsequent ones also sell that well?
Also sell, but not like that, you know, but they were all good sellers.
So you've got an ear for success in some way.
Some, you can have some dogs as well that don't sell. But, you know, you talk about the ones that did well, and people look at you for the ones that did sell. The other one that was a bit crazy was Richard Clayderman.
Mm.
So we'll talk about Richard Clayderman and how I saw Richard Clayderman. I looked at the charts in France, and every week, number one spot was Richard Clayderman.
And was he was a pianist,
He was the pianist.
Okay, so we'll talk about him, but again, after the break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You're listening to the AutJet Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we're busy talking to Ivor Harberger, who's taking us through his journey through through Gallo Records to become the CEO eventually, and he took us through the stories of Barry White and Donna Summer and Bonnie M, and now talking about the pianist
Richard Clayderman,
and just tell us the story.
So what I was going through various magazines, and there was one called Music Mart, and we used to get Music Mart on a regular basis, and they used to have the charts, and number one, Richard Clayderman. Next week, number one, Richard Clayderman. Next one, I've got to go and find out about Richard Clayderman. So I knew no one in Paris. That's where he came from. I took the flight and I booked into a hotel and I got the address of Delphine Records or whatever. Next morning, I called a taxi and I said, I need to go to Delphine Records. And they dropped me off. I said, but there's no record company here. I look around, couldn't see the record company. walked up and down the street, and then I opened a door, and I saw this area. And I walked through, and I saw these beautiful models that Delphine was about, but there was nothing about the record company. So I walked into reception, and I said, who do I speak to about the record, the Richard Clayton? They said, go to the second floor. I went into the second floor, and I met this guy, Oliver Moussant. And I said to Oliver, you don't know me. I'm from South Africa. I've come to sign Richard Clayton. I know he's a pianist and whatever. And I got on very well with him. He says, we're from South Africa. We've got no representation in South Africa. So I said, I'd like to release Richard Clayton. And have you got videos? We'd like to, you know, get him away and that. And that's how I signed Richard Clayton. And, you know, it was over Christmas and Mother's Day, and it was a great Christmas present. And people used to go into the stores. There was Dion's and this one and that one, and they used to buy Richard Clayton. And eventually he toured here. But you can't believe the sales that we got out of Richard Clayton. And I don't know where Richard Clayton is today. He's disappeared. Yeah.
So I could hop on a plane and go somewhere and try and meet someone, and I'll be...
It doesn't just happen in the music business.
No, but I'll be blocked by doors. What is it, you think, about your approach, about yourself, that allows that people open their doors to you and introduce you to these people?
Well, some of them go very well. Others don't go so well, you know, because here you arrive as a stranger in a lot of the places. Who are you? What do you do? What is your company? And I dealt with the Japanese, and the Japanese heard about African music, and they wanted African music for the Japanese market. So we got talking to a company called Conversations, and Conversations were held by a bigger company that people might know, that there's departmental stores in the whole of Japan called Parco, P-A-R-C-O, and they had concert halls and things like that. And we started communicating, and they said, look, we're sending two youngsters to see that you actually exist, that you've actually got a record company here. So the two guys arrived, and I took them to the hotel, and I said, this is us, and I showed them Gallows. And then Gallows said to me, look, the guys are here, take them to the game reserve. So I said, okay, where should I take them to? And they said, go to one of the top places there, take these two Japanese guys. And they were youngsters. But there they were, looking at taking photos, doing this, meeting the people at Gallo. And I took them in my car. And as I was approaching Nell Street, I got a speeding ticket. I didn't start off too well. And when we booked into the lodge, I said, guys, be here and be ready to go out onto to the mobiles at 5 o'clock or whatever it was. And they booked in, and we gave them the rooms and things like that. And I said, everybody be here at 5 o'clock because we're going to go out on the Land Rovers. So the one guy was there, and the other guy didn't pitch up. So he goes and goes. He says, where's the guy? I said, he's late. And so the one ranger goes and looks and says, I can't find him. He's not in his room. So they alerted everybody to go and check where this Japanese guy was. He says, you know, did he walk into the bush? And nobody could find him. Eventually, I got into his room, and he's folded up under the blankets, under the eiderdown, sitting like this, and he was totally asleep. He couldn't wake up. He was so tired from jet lag and whatever. So we woke him up, and that was the first outing that we had with the Japanese. And then they sent different people to South Africa, more senior people, to say, look, we want to release products in South Africa. We understand you have a fairly large company, and we want to do business, and we want to do touring with you. We want some of the artists that you're releasing to come to Japan and perform. And that worked very, very well.
And so what do you see as Ivor, as your success factors? Like what made you progress through Gallo, and what made you successful? And I know you've got an absolute passion for the music, but there's got to be more than that.
Look, there's the passion and there's the enjoyment, you know, going to concerts, seeing how people perform and things like that. But there's also a lot of things that go wrong that you expect that you're going to do very, very well with, and they don't happen. You know, and I learned very, very quickly, there was an artist called Lovelace Watkins. And Lovelace Watkins was performing in Swaziland, and people came back, and one of the promoters brought him to the Coliseum. And I met with Lovelace Watkins, and he said, look, Ivor, I need certain equipment that I need to rehearse with the band. So there was a store in Kotze Street called Radio Manny, and he had all sorts of equipment and stuff, and I went to Radio Manny and I said, they need a Revox, they need this, and they were all staying at the Landros Hotel. And I took all the stuff to the Landros Hotel, and Lovelace said, thanks very much, you know, we hooked up and everything's working, I can rehearse with the band and everything. When Lovelace left South Africa, I go to the hotel to collect the stuff. I speak to the manager and I say, I've come to collect all the stuff. He said, no, he gave it away.
He gave it to other people.
Yeah, he just gave it, gave all the stuff away. And the same thing happened, I don't know if people will remember the Landros Hotel. So we had Dobie Gray here from America. And Dobie came and we had press conferences, we had the TV here and we had everything. And when it came to paying the bill, I looked at his liquor bill. And I said, this is impossible that somebody can spend so much money. So I went and I said, look, you must have, I said, he had dinner with us, we had the cocktail party, we went to Durban, how can it be so much? And everybody came to do an interview, he gave a bottle of whiskey, but it wasn't Tots, he was buying the bottle and giving them a bottle from the bar as a thank you present.
So he was saying thank you on your bill.
On my bill?
On your bill.
So you learn very quickly about the mistakes that you do.
Do you find a lot of these artists that are well known, are they prima donnas or are they down to earth?
I find, first of all, the international artists, I feel a lot of them have got a chip on their shoulders sometimes. And in all my years in the industry, I never got one thank you saying, the tour was fantastic, thanks for the support we've got over the period, our gold records that we've received. Never, ever have I received a thank you on behalf of any of those records, of those people. At one time I lent Leo Sayer socks. He forgot his socks. And he was performing at Sun City. He phoned up, he said, Ivo, I haven't got any socks. And I phoned my friend Selwyn Gershman, who was in the business. And Selwyn gave me six pairs of socks. And I gave them to Leo Sayer. And he said, listen, ever come to London, this is my number. Da-da-da-da. It never works. It never works out.
Yeah. So do you find like they feel like they're entitled, like,
you know,
just the thing of giving a bottle of whiskey away for nothing.
They don't even ask, you know, they just do it.
Yeah.
They just do it, yeah.
So I want to get to some of maybe your life lessons, some of the things that you can share from your experience that other people can take on help them be successful, but we'll do that after the break.
Okay.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You're listening to the AutJet Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we're busy talking to Ivor Harberger. And we're very lucky to have Ivor with us today. On many different levels. On the one level is during COVID time, Ivor was in hospital, literally on your deathbed. Amazing that you pulled through. And you seem to handle failure in an amazing way, both during COVID and when you met with people and things didn't go right, you just continued building on that. Ivor, what is your secret to dealing with hardships and some of your life lessons that you can share with us?
I think one of the things that I find is always very important is communication. Communication with your overseas licensees, overseas people that you're doing business with, your tour people, and locally your commitment to your artists that you're working with. And they want to know exactly what you're doing. Your reports are important. Internationally, I used to send a report every month on the 25th of December to my licensees around the world, telling them what's happening and their sales figures. And I think even today, your communication with people is so important. Don't just leave them in the dark. Tell them what you're doing. And I think that's very, very important. You always need the relationship with both your artists and your international partners.
So the communication is important, but it's
important.
Part of building the relationship. So the relationships, I hear you saying, are important.
Very important. Some of the people that I deal with around the world, I am still in contact with them today.
And this is many years later. Many years later. Don't need to be in contact, but
no,
you still are.
I'm still in contact with them. We commute. We do things. Some of them have been to South Africa on holiday. I've been to the United States. We've met our people there on a regular basis. I've stayed with certain of my licensees. And that relationships are very important in all ways, their side and our side as well.
And if you can think back on your whole working career, what sticks out in your mind as either fantastic or terrible, but what incident or thing that happened sticks out in your mind?
One of the problems I had was when Miriam Makeba came back to South Africa after spending 40 years in exile. The press got hold of it and they started writing articles about how much Gala owed her over the period she was away. And when she was with Gala in our area where we kept all the masters and the thing, we had, I think, 89 shellacs of Miriam records.
So shellacs are the
plastic records that break.
Plastic records, yeah.
So we had 89 tracks, but we never released 7 singles or albums in those days. But over the period, we put compilations and stuff together, and people wanted, you know, the click song, and there was Pata Pata, and she had some big... And all of a sudden, the bad publicity was coming through. And she had a manager who was very verbal and stating that Gallows was ripped off over the period, money was being received, and it became a major problem. And they said, oh, if it's affecting the share price and whatever, you better go and sort it out. So I thought, oh, now I've got to go to Miriam. It's going to be a huge political situation. And she stayed in Kaya Sands, and I made an appointment, and I went and had a cup of tea with Miriam. And I said, Miriam, look, these royalty statements have come through. We still got your shellacs. They are in excellent condition. And we'd like to continue the relationship. And I had to spend a lot of time with Miriam convincing her that Gallows is the team. And I came up with a suggestion for her. And I said, why don't we just form a company and all the revenue that we are able to get from book sales, television, record sales, film opportunities, we put into this company. Gallows will manage it, and we would take 20%, and the 80% would go to you. And eventually, you know, when I went and had another cup of tea with her, and we tried to put things together and do the legal work, and I said, we'll form this company, and everything will come in. Then I started, and I said, where's all your legal work? Where are your documentations? Wherever? She said, no, they're in Paris with a lawyer there. Try to get hold of the guy in Paris, and he just didn't discuss anything with us. We then got, by chance, a guy came from the French embassy, and he said, Ivor, we've got a gentleman here. He wants to join the music. He's doing his MBA. Have you got a position for him? And I said, yes, come, I'll see him. And then Xavier came, he stayed with me for 6 months. And we worked out that through the internet that she recorded 67 albums. And then we started trying to get all the documentation of Miriam Makeba. And then one day she put her arms around me and she said to me, Ivor, I started at Gallows and I wanted to come back to Gallows. But yeah, over a period, it didn't work so well. But we got it all together at the end.
Wow, that's amazing. So... Craig has just given me the signal that we need to start wrapping up. So first of all, I want to thank Craig for the work that he does, managing us in the process. And I want to take away, you know, they talk about the 7 C's, but I've just got the 2 C's from you, which is communication and commitment. And it kind of goes hand in hand. And to be successful, the lessons of success from Ivor Harberger are communicate, and then be committed to it and follow it through. Ivor, thanks for joining us. This has been incredible insight into the music industry. You've been listening to the Orchard Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we'll see you next time.